League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Hello and welcome to The Sci Guys, the show where we talk about the crazy, weird, and wonderful stories from the science world. I'm Corey, and as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Jamp and Luke Cutford.
Hi.
Hi. Howdy.
This week, we're talking about dying dreams and mortal memories.
Ooh.
But first, we've got a little Spotify update.
Of course we have.
So I had a look at Spotify, and it's actually very, very cool. We're sitting just under 48,000 listeners, so 47,900. But we've hit 30,000 followers, 31,303.
Wow.
That's
we did
so
it.
Cool.
Yeah, we did it. We said, let's hit 30K, and
the
we did it.
Big 3-0, we're in our 30s now.
So I think for next time, we could try and hit 35K.
Of
easy,
course.
The next easy. Time we bring this up, it's a bit of a stretch, but I think we can do it.
No, they smash it out of the park every time. Go
absolutely.
On.
Absolutely. Yeah. So tell a friend, and then tell that friend to tell a friend, and tell that friend to tell a friend to tell a friend.
And then
to
like
follow us on Spotify.
7 degrees deep, we've got the whole Earth subscribed or something.
Exactly. And a question for everyone as well. So if you're listening on Spotify, obviously follow us, but head over to YouTube and answer this question in the comments. What do you want to happen to your body when you die? Do you want to be cremated, buried, stuffed? What do you want to happen? Let us know.
I actually don't know.
You don't know?
Mm.
What do you want, Luke?
I want that thing that happens in Doctor Who where they're on like a floating pyre and then you fire a flaming arrow at it from the shore and then I go up in flames in the sea.
You mean a Viking burial?
I want a Viking burial.
And your reference for that is Doctor Who.
Yes.
Wherein that happens to Matt Smith.
Yes. Well, because I'm Matt Smith, so, you know. Anything that happens to him has to happen to me. Does anything bad happen to him? He burns to death on a pyre. Okay.
Mm. No, a replica version of him burns to death.
Thank goodness.
And then he's murdered a lot later. Anyway.
Well, I have to be cloned first.
So no one really knows what happens when you die. There obviously is the classic trope of your life flashing before your eyes. You guys know that, right?
Yeah, I was thinking about this yesterday because I've been reading a lot about like the science, the neuroscience of consciousness and how the brain like models reality and that kind of stuff. And I was trying to figure
of
out
course.
What... Yeah.
Just weekend reading.
Just doing some light reading.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, just before bed.
Honestly, sometimes I'm like, I'm getting ready to like cook a meal and I'm like, I'm going to stick on something fun. Where's that book about the science of consciousness? It's called Being You by Anil Seth, and it's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
But I was thinking about this thing about life flashing before your eyes last night when I was at the theater for some reason. I was thinking about this, and
must have not been very good.
What were you watching?
I was watching Back to the Future the musical. Two shout outs for two products in 10 seconds. Fantastic. And I was trying to figure out like what on earth would be the reason why your life flashes before your eyes, like the neuroscientific reason. Because like you could understand if you're in like a dangerous or high stakes scenario, your brain like forward simulating the repercussions of any action in order to try and stay alive. But why on earth would it go back in time?
It's because when you get to heaven, there's a test on remembering all the stuff that you've done.
Yeah.
And so...
Like the quickfire quiz.
Yeah, like the quickfire quiz.
Yeah. That's you have to answer every quickfire quiz question to get to the pearly gates.
It's like, you get to like, what is it, St. Michael? You know? And he's okay, now what happened when you were five?
Yeah.
Right? What happened? What was the most embarrassing thing that happened when you were five? And if you don't get it right, you go straight down to hell.
But St. Michael is just Corey with a fake mustache on.
That is not true, okay? Oh. We have been pictured in the same room. Absolutely.
You and St. Michael.
I've never seen you and St. Michael in the same room, to be fair.
It's
I won't believe it
phone,
until I have photo evidence.
Which I'm looking at the picture right now.
That's
on my phone.
Convenient that you're not.
Can I see the picture?
Oh, my phone died. Sorry. Maybe next time.
Okay.
So,
maybe you can send it to me and I'll put it on screen for the
And you
for
can
the
put it in the references because you have to cite your sources, Corey. Yeah.
So we might be moving a few steps to closer to actually figuring out what happens when you die. We've obviously not proven that your life flashes before your eyes, but thanks to a paper that came out in February 2022,
mm-hmm.
we have a slightly better idea, or we might have a slightly better idea. And interestingly, death might actually cause your brain to give a short slideshow of your memories.
Oh, that's nice.
It's nice,
just
right?
Like the highlights.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't. Maybe it's the low lights.
Like
who knows?
Like a highlight sizzle, you know,
like PowerPoint presentation.
Like at the end of the year, how we do our best of Sci Guys. You know, it's exactly the same as that.
You know, company meetings. Like at the end of year company meeting, they like pop a slideshow, and it's like, what we achieved this year. It's like that, but you've never worked for a company.
No.
So this is like alien to you.
I've not been anywhere.
It's very uncomfortable.
So near-death experiences, do either of you know anything about those?
Apparently some freaky stuff can happen.
I have seen this idea in, like near-death experiences that like people talk about like, oh, I was driving on the motorway and I crashed in a car and then like I crashed into a truck, say, and then I flashed backwards and I hadn't hit the truck yet. And that's actually a really interesting topic to think about how or why that might happen, how or why you might have the subjective experience of crash. Like assuming they're telling the truth, why somebody might have that subjective experience. And you can sort of reason it out as possibly to do with the fact that your brain is always trying to forward simulate what's about to happen.
That right? Just sounds like kind of falling asleep at the wheel for the smallest amount of time and then waking up.
Yeah, maybe.
That's what it sounds like to me.
Yeah.
You know, because I've had dreams where I think I'm doing something. Like, last night, I dreamt that I couldn't breathe properly. Like, I had something wrong with my throat. And then I woke up, and I was like, ooh, a bit scratchy. Done a test. All good. Mm-hmm. I was like, ooh, a bit scratchy. What's that all about? You know, you can dream things that are going to happen or that you think are going to happen, you know? That's not really an example of that, but still, I just wanted to talk about a little dream.
But yeah, as for near-death experience, I don't know an awful lot, to be honest, other than they're abbreviated to NDEs.
I remember as a kid watching it, that was like middle-of-the-day TV, and there used to be like a Dr. Phil-style American show that was called something like I Went to Hell. And they just got all these like random Americans on who had near-death experiences talking about like what they saw when they went to hell in their near-death. Like they momentarily died, but then they came back to life.
Yes, I've read a book called Proof of Heaven that has a bunch of like that sort of description, saying I had a subjective experience of this, therefore it is then true that it exists. And I think that is a fundamental misunderstanding of your own brain.
Had this experience where I was a superhero and I could reshape the world as I saw fit. So that's clearly actually
that
happening.
Sounds real. Yeah,
it funnily enough, it happened between me going to sleep one night and waking up the next day, but absolutely, definitely.
It's just,
That's
you
what
can
happen.
Ignore that.
Yeah, you can just ignore the context of that. No, I feel like people, it's interesting. People take experiences that they have and they almost always see them as real, right? Like you know, that's why I think in some part, that's why we've got ghost stories and whatnot, right? Wherein people will have an experience and instead of sort of writing it off as, my brain has just done a weird thing, it's, my experience is real.
Yeah.
What can explain that?
But I think that's because people don't understand that what they're experiencing and the thing they call the world is a sort of hallucination dream that is an approximation of the outside world, but you're not ever experiencing the outside world. And I think the majority of people don't understand that. You have no access to the outside world other than through your brain. And so, yes, when you experience something, you think, oh, well, then it must be, I must have experienced something based on a property of the actual objective world. Therefore, ghosts exist, as opposed to like, my brain did a thing.
Yeah. Because to be fair, I think it's hard to conceptualize that because you don't know the power of your brain most times, right?
It's hard to conceptualize it, but equally, you experience it all the time. Like, people have looked, like, surely at some point you have looked at something and thought it was like a dog or thought it was like, or thought another person was your friend and you were like certain you saw that face and then you look closer and you realize it's like a pile of clothes. I always mistake piles of things for my cat out the corner of my eye.
So looking into hypervigilance actually really has helped me a lot. So do you remember we were talking about that sort of hypervigilant state that you're in when you're sort of in your sort of sleep-wake cycle, when you're sort of waking up, similar to when you've got sleep paralysis, right?
I did not remember that. I thought hypervigilance was like almost like anxiety.
So there is, yes, that is the correct term for that. I think I'm using the wrong word. There's this state where you're waking up or falling asleep that can happen sometimes where in your brain just enters this mode of like, everything could be dangerous.
Oh, right? Okay. Yeah, like you've partially woken up, but you're still also like hallucinating.
Kind of, yeah. And so sometimes if I'm tired or it's really late at night, sometimes I feel like I can feel very scared. I'm like, something is, and it genuinely is like being in a horror movie. And since I looked into this sort of thing, just incidentally through looking into something else, I've noticed that, and I've been able to be like, oh. Well, yes, you are acting irrationally scared right now, because your brain is just in this very vigilant state. So you don't need to be worried about it.
And do you know why? Is it like part of the brain is still asleep, say, the part that deals with threat? And so the other parts are like, the threat detector is asleep, so let's assume everything's really threatening.
I would say go back and listen to our sleep paralysis episode, because yeah, I don't remember the most accurate answers. Head.
Yeah.
But yeah, so near-death experiences, it's interesting, actually, because people who have died and then been resuscitated, this, actually, the quote that I've got here says, men and women who have died and been successfully resuscitated sometimes undergo what is called near-death experiences, which is obviously something that is not available to non-binary people. It just doesn't happen. Only men and women, evidently.
They don't die, non-binary people.
They don't. Yeah. They are immortal. Yeah. This is true.
That's so interesting how baked into our language it is to say men and women.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Like, why not just say people?
This is honestly really bothering to me. I think maybe they're trying to say adults. I don't know. But the fact that scientific papers need to be precise... Died. My uncle actually almost died. I was going to tell this story at some point. I was going to actually call him to see if he if he remembered anything, but I've not called him in a little bit. So I feel like if I were to call him right now and say, hey, remember that time that you almost died? Want to give me a rundown of that?
You're live on the podcast. Go.
Exactly. So I think he fell off the back of a bus when he was 5.
Oh.
And he died for a bit. And then he was resuscitated. He's fine now. Well, he's generally pretty fine now. No, he's good now. He's good now.
He's alive now.
He's alive now. Yeah, he's alive now. He's good. But he's never spoken to me about that being a particularly life-changing experience or whatever. But then again, he was 5 years old. Anyway, people who sort of have their heart stop and then are resuscitated can apparently recall being detached from their dying body, often seeing their body from the outside. They pass through a bright light, sometimes through a dark tunnel, and feel that the light is welcoming them. The whole experience is usually characterized by a feeling of detachment and peace. Mm-hmm. And also, apparently, this can happen to about 15% of people who undergo cardiac arrest and then are resuscitated. So if your heart stops and then it's restarted, 15% of people that go through that say they've had some kind of a near-death experience, or sort of, in some cases, a sort of out-of-body experience. Mm-hmm. And you can also have a near-death experience under general anesthesia. This is not an episode on near-death experiences. We could do an episode on near-death experiences, but as far as I'm aware, from what I've read on this, it seems interesting. It's almost like, because you can have a near-death experience under general anesthesia, to me, that just reads as you can simulate this with drugs. This is almost like going on some kind of trip, right? Like,
it's just something the brain can do.
Because I've read stories of people on psychedelics who have had similar experiences of being detached from their body and whatnot and having a feeling of bliss and all of this. So is that maybe not what those are?
Yeah.
Interestingly, there's a whole chapter in this book I'm reading right now about exactly this.
Really?
And it's to do with the way that they're sort of understanding, like science's understanding of how your brain creates the sense of self. So right now you think, you feel like you are a thing that is experiencing.
Yeah.
But that sort of discounts the fact that the feeling that you are a thing is also something you're experiencing, right? So like the thought or the experience of being a thing is in itself an experience that you are having, right? And so there are these sort of experiments you can do where you put people in, for example, VR, and you show them, for example, in VR, a video of themselves from a third person perspective. Mm-hmm. And basically the part of the brain that is constructing like the first person perspective and the idea of the self can, under certain psychiatric conditions and by stimulation of certain areas of the brain, sort of be convinced to or forced to sort of detach from the other aspects of self that you have, such as like having a body. So you can basically show people in VR themselves from a third person perspective, and they, if you then turn the lights off, say, and you take their VR goggles off and you ask them to walk towards their body, they'll walk towards the point that they were looking from, as opposed to from the point where their body is.
That's wild.
I might have got some of that wrong, but basically there are a bunch of experiments in science that are dealing with at the moment, trying to figure out how the brain constructs itself. And the long and the short of it is basically that the idea that you are in a body and the idea that you have a body is in and of itself an experience that you are having.
Send those my way. Let's do this in a future episode.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. So those are sort of near-death experiences, right? And this is kind of tangentially related to what we're talking about today. So I just wanted to bring up the idea that when you sort of die or go through the process of death, there at least are some shared experiences that people have. And obviously we don't know what happens on the sort of full transition to death, because generally speaking to someone that is fully dead is kind of tough, you know. It's just, you know, they're generally kind
have
of non-responsive.
I don't think we've tried, Corey. I'm going to go on a limb here and say I don't think we've tried.
I think we actually have tried. So
no, we've not tried to speak to someone who's fully dead and will remain dead and doesn't come back.
Luke, we did this in an episode before where we were talking about, oh gosh, what was it? Was it Undead Pork? I think episode 3, where we were talking about the beheadings and people studying beheadings in France, and apparently people were blinking, lips were moving, and trying to talk and stuff. I think if it comes to talking to someone that's dead and staying dead, I think we've made some attempts, you know.
Okay.
Some pretty good attempts. And also, I feel like during murder cases, way back before they had, you know, forensic science, they probably were trying to just talk to dead bodies and see what happened, you know?
Psst. Yeah. Who killed you?
Come on, give us a tip.
Just anything. Heckler.
We'll cut you a plea deal. You're implicated in this case.
You're withholding evidence.
Oh my God.
Send him to the slammer. It's this dead body in jail.
Ding-a-ling-ling, it's the ad bell. What are we advertising today?
We're advertising our spicy merch. I am wearing the tardigrade beanie that we're selling. It's a little tardigrade boy, little water bear going, ooh.
And if you like the tardigrade beanie, you could also get our matching tardigrade t-shirt with a little smiling tardigrade that isn't going ooh, but is going ee.
And if you like the tardigrade t-shirt, you might also like the Sci Guys little pin badges we've made.
Wow.
They don't match, but they do say Sci Guys, and you can show your love for Sci Guys in your pin badge collection, and they're very cute.
Yeah, it's the actual logo.
And there's still a chance to grab our Sci Guys calendar, which will give you a discount on the future calendar if you get it now.
And an extra episode of Sci Guys, all about calendars.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah, they will get
that.
The
calendar episode, yeah.
Well, that's the spawn from ourselves. Back to the episode.
So that's near-death experiences, obviously. Let's move on to the actual case study here. So what actually happened is a man in 2016, he was 87-year-old.
He was 87-year-olds? In a trench coat?
He was 87-year-old in a trench coat.
He must have been really tall.
He was a very, very tall man.
That's like three classrooms.
Yeah, he took a fall, and oh boy, were they injured. No, he actually did take a fall. So this, as I said, is the first time we've had observational evidence on the transition from life to death.
Aww.
So how do you think they got this evidence?
FMRI.
An FMRI?
Yeah.
How would they do that, though?
Put a dying guy in an FMRI machine.
Jesus, Luke, that's very dark.
What do you mean?
Oh, you're dying? Let's just chuck you in an MRI.
They used to chop people's heads off and then lift up their decapitated head and see if they could still blink.
But we don't live in such barbaric times.
Sticking a dying guy in an FMRI is nowhere near as bad.
Sorry, they were chopping the heads off anyway, and they had to take the heads.
And the guy's dying anyway. What do you mean?
That's really cold.
I feel like if you want to die with dignity, you don't want to die in an MRI machine.
One final giving away to the world.
But also, no. This isn't a sort of insult on your idea. How would they do this? Like, genuinely, how do you think that they would do this?
Because they can't necessarily time when he's going to die.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know. Is he being put down?
Jesus, Luke. Oh my God! Chemical injection.
What is wrong with you?
I don't know. I'm putting out ideas. Places put people down. That happens. It's horrible. I'm not saying it's good. It's crap. It's really awful. But it does happen. They used to chop people's heads off, Corey. I don't know why.
Jap, do you have any other ideas on how they might have done this?
No. Strangled him.
Gee. Okay.
Oh, we're not talking about the death, just how they scanned it.
Yeah. Well, how they figured this out.
Oh, I don't know. They asked him.
Okay, so Luke was kind of onto something.
Thank you.
Kind of.
Okay.
He went the horrific, horrible route. So there was an 87-year-old man in 2016 who had epilepsy, and he went to A&E because he had a fall. He had a sort of rapidly deteriorating neurological condition, so they gave him some neurological tests, and he was just starting to sort of rapidly decline. So they gave him a CT scan and found bilateral subdural hematomas. Do you know what those are?
No.
No?
No?
It's like hematoma is some sort of like sack full of liquid, right? Usually it's blood or something.
Yes. Yeah, so
and it's bilateral. Is it like in both sides of the brain?
Mm-hmm.
So you've got sacks of liquid in both sides of your brain.
So you're right. So bilateral, both sides. Subdural.
Teamwork.
Subdural basically means between the skull and the brain's surface. Oh. And a hematoma is a collection of sort of clotting blood, kind of like a really bad bruise. So spot on. You could figure this out. This is why we like to learn Greek and Latin and other such languages so that we can just figure things out in science.
Between the two of us, we could be a doctor.
No. Yeah, we're one whole Corrie.
This is a podcast of two people.
Two Corries.
You'd be a kind of doctor that, to figure out what happens when someone dies, would murder them. Jap, you would strangle him.
I'm not saying I would do that.
That was your first. I don't want to go to this doctor.
My first one wasn't that, but it didn't make sense.
He had bilateral subdural hematomas. He had real bad bruises between the brain and the skull on both sides of his brain. So they gave him a left decompressive craniotomy, which, what do you think that might be?
Putting a syringe in and sucking out the liquid.
It's essentially a surgery to alleviate cranial pressure. So to stop that, the sort of blood that's pooling there from putting too much pressure on the brain and causing more damage. Nice. And he was stable for 2 days post-op in the ICU. And then they gave him another CT scan, and he was given some anticonvulsant drugs because, obviously, injury to the brain, epilepsy could potentially cause seizures. Yeah. And he had an EEG, and they noticed left hemisphere seizures there. I've got a quote here. There were at least 12 identified electrographic seizures, after which a burst suppression pattern spontaneously developed over the left hemisphere. Shortly thereafter, electrographic activity over both hemispheres demonstrated a burst suppression pattern, which was followed by development of ventricular tachycardia with apneistic respirations and clinical cardiorespiratory arrest. So.
He died.
Yeah.
A CT scan.
I was going to say, what is the... In the EEG. During the EEG. Yeah, okay. So... During the EEG, essentially what all of this means is he had a seizure during the EEG, and then he had a ventricular tachycardia, which essentially means he had a fast heart rate. And then I think it's apneistic is how you, or apneistic is how you say it, apneistic respirations. That's kind of like essentially a death rattle, followed by cardiorespiratory arrest. What do you think that means?
Stop breathing.
Yeah, stop breathing. Oh. Stop your heart pumping as well. Just
that's very straight
up dead. Yeah. So... they also I've got another quote here saying, after discussion with the patient's family and consideration of the do not resuscitate status of the patient, no further treatment was administered and the patient passed away. So the man died essentially during an EEG, which is how they managed to get the data to study this. Entirely accidentally, they were just trying to do an EEG on this guy and he died.
He just died.
Is that data separable from the seizure though?
Well, kind of, yes. So you've kind of hit on an actual issue here. So I'll give you a quote from the doctor that was the senior researcher on this study, because it kind of explains what's going on here. So just before and after the heart stopped working, we saw changes in a specific band of neural oscillations. Essentially, they saw changes. They saw changes before and after the heart stopped working, which, you know what seizures look like on an EEG generally. You'll be able to like tell if it's different from normal.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily normal for this guy, because they didn't get to do a baseline EEG,
right.
So they didn't know what his sort of normal patterns were. But they were, obviously, you can compare it to. One would assume you'd be able to compare it to generally what EEGs look like with other people.
Yeah.
So as you probably get now, the guy died during an EEG, and they did a study on this to try and figure out what is going on in his brain. And interestingly, as I said, this was published in 2022, but the man died in 2016. So what do you think they were doing in that intervening time?
Writing it.
Passing through ethics committees?
Oh, maybe. Listen, so this guy accidentally died. And we just happened to record
lawyering
it.
Lawyering up.
Good one. No, I think this is actually probably a pretty easy one for an ethics committee, because you've got the data already, right?
You know,
it's there. Yeah. You just need to analyze it. So what they were doing actually was trying to find examples of this happening elsewhere, and also waiting to see if this would happen.
Oh god.
Which is really macabre, I think, you know.
Rates of CT scans among seizure patients have shot up dramatically since 2016.
It would be really worrying if suddenly there was just a dramatic increase of people dying during EEGs.
Yeah. Do we just go for an EEG quickly? It's just standard procedure now.
He just went for a routine checkup, and then it turned out that he was suddenly dying, and he died there and then. I don't know what happened. Dear me.
I know, man. The history of science is not great.
No, look, okay, let's be realistic. If they were actually, if this was being done, say, 50 years ago, that's the 70s. If this was being done maybe between 50 to 80 years ago, and they had all the technology that we've got now, we know exactly what would happen. There'd be a sign that would go up in poor black neighborhoods.
All black people.
Free medical care.
Oh, God.
Or failing that, we might go to, I don't know, a poor country in South America and just scoop up some of their women. You know.
No way. You think?
I don't know. We could do
mad.
That.
I don't know. I think that's a conspiracy theory, man.
Oh dear.
It does sound like a conspiracy theory, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That the way that we got the pill was through exploiting women in, I think, Central and South America.
Crazy.
But it's what happened.
Wow.
Oh, God.
Deary me. No, so luckily this was not done, you know, quite a while ago. We've got a little bit more of a stronger sense of ethics in, you know, science. So we didn't just murder some, you know, people that are undesirable to American society.
Oh god.
They waited to see if there were any more examples of this that would crop up, and they couldn't find any. So they published it this year after 6 years. And as I said, they didn't have a baseline EEG recording to work from because of how quickly this all happened. But essentially, do you know what an EEG does?
No. It measures the electrical fields around the brain.
Yeah,
it's very sensitive. It's not very accurate. It's not very like sharp in definition, or in time, I think. But it allows you. It's more direct than an MRI, which measures the blood flow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Okay. So it stands for electroencephalogram. Encephalo, obviously, to do with the brain. Encephalopathy. And all that stuff. Yeah, it's a very tough one to say. So obviously it's just a sort of scan of your brain to see the sort of electrical activity. It's essentially measuring the brain waves. So brain waves or neural oscillations have different classifications. Do you know what they are and what differentiates them?
No.
Is it the like the A, B, C, like or alpha, the delta waves, and it's to do with the frequencies?
Yes, yeah, exactly. So it's to do with the frequencies. Gamma has the highest frequency of 30 to 100 hertz. Yeah. And gamma is the one that you usually see when people access memories during dreams. That's the one that they were looking at. So you've got, like, I think alpha, beta, delta, all of those other ones.
They were looking at when they were doing the EEG on him.
So the
CT scan.
So the EEG was scans for all of it, essentially, right? Yeah. They've got data on all of it.
Okay.
But in the actual study, they were focusing on the gamma waves because those are the ones that showed the changes.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
So that's the ones that they want to focus on because they saw a change in those, and also gamma waves are, as I said, are usually seen when people access memories during dreams. You know?
And that's the life flashing before your eyes.
Exactly. That's exactly that was the sort of the thought process there. And so I've got this from the paper. They analyzed readings from four different times, which is the interictal interval, which is from 385 to 415 seconds after the clinical seizure. So he didn't die sort of during the seizure. It was kind of after the seizure. So that's why they were able to separate it from the seizure, right? Because it was separate. But then again, obviously, I think it's not a case of your brain just goes back entirely to normal directly after a seizure.
Yeah, there can be ripples, I'm sure.
I'm sure there's going to be some after effects based on that. There's also the left suppression window, which was and sort of the midpoint between the midpoint between the left and bilateral hemispheric activity. What that essentially means is there was a lot of activity on the left, and then it switched to being activity on both sides of the brain. So that would be that period that they're looking at there. And then the bilateral suppression window, which is between when both parts of the brain, both sides of the brain were active, and cardiac arrest. So between both sides of his brain being active and then him dying, that was the bilateral suppression. And then the final window was the post-cardiac arrest, a period from 810 seconds to 840 seconds at the midpoint between cardiac arrest and the end of the EEG recording. So the four different periods are essentially after the clinical seizure, but before the sort of left part of the brain was active, and then when the left part of the brain was active, and then when both sides of the brain were really active, and then finally after he died. Yeah?
Yeah.
So those were the four bits that they're looking at. So you've kind of got a before, during, and after of death there, which is insane, by the way. Like, I've kind of skimmed over this a little bit. It is absolutely incredible that we've got this data. Very sad that the man died, you know. But we've incredible that we've got this data for the entire period of death, which is, I mean, incredible, right? Like, we've not, as far as aware, the researchers have said themselves, we have not had this data before.
Yeah.
And it is pretty incredible to be able to see this is what happens to a brain when it is dying, because we've got so many questions about this, and obviously our entire experience is essentially filtered through our brain, or that's, you know, the way that science would look at it.
Yeah,
that's the prevailing theory, right? Yeah. And it's the prevailing theory that has any sort of evidence behind it, if that makes sense.
Prediction, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Like, when I say evidence, I mean sort of physical evidence, right? You know, mm-hmm. We could talk about the sort of metaphysical stuff. We could talk about all of your sort of spiritual this and that, but ultimately we don't have any concrete proof of that.
Yeah,
this is the theory that we've got, and it is incredible that we've actually got some data on it. So I've got another quote from the paper here. It says, after a cardiac arrest, the relative amount of gamma power increased compared to the interictal level, while a reduction of delta, beta, alpha, and absolute gamma waves was identified. And so those oscillations were similar to what had been seen in rodents, because he'd done similar experiments on rodents, and there was quite a similarity between the results that they got from this man and the results that they got from the rodents. And so what this essentially looked like was brain waves that were similar to the brain waves that happen when you're sort of remembering things during dreams. Those were happening at the same sort of time as the man was dying. That's essentially why they're thinking, you know, you've sort of you're running back all your memories as you're dying.
Sorry, can I just take a look? Yeah, go for it. Out of interest, was there any mention in this paper to do with any sort of measurements of consciousness, any measurements that are like neurocorrelates for whether the person would be conscious experiencing this? Because obviously your brain can fire off, but if you're already gone, then you're not going to have any experience of it.
No, I don't think there was, because this is one of the limitations. We'll get to that at the end, but it's hard to really say that because we're just looking at the brain waves, like just the sort of I guess the power of the brain waves. And so it's really hard, I think, to tell what the internal experience is from just that, you know, because it's not, it's, how to put it, I guess it's not as fine a device as sort of looking in other ways, you know, like I think with an fMRI, you can see exactly where the blood is going in the brain, right? So you can be like, okay, this part of the brain is like lit up essentially, whereas with an EEG, I think it's a little bit more which brain waves you're looking at rather than like which specific areas of the brain.
Not very sharp at all.
EEG,
as far as I know. But then it's more direct in some ways, because like there might not be a correlation between where the brain, what the brain's doing, and what part of the brain is is taking blood.
Absolutely.
There might be a slight, or like a time delay or that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are things that we can infer from brain waves that we can't infer from an MRI. But interesting, like obviously it's just not really possible to measure everything at once. And in this case, obviously they were stuck with just the data. It was just, I mean, God, I hate to say it this way, it was a lucky coincidence that that they were measuring that at the, like when he died, right? Like it's not lucky that he died when they were measuring, but in a sense for science it's very lucky that they got that data.
What I'm amazed at as well, which is really interesting, is that they didn't turn off the EEG, because and it's very, very like good that they didn't. You may as well capture the data if you can, but if it was any other, like if I was recording somebody, if I was filming somebody, you would instinctively, just without even really thinking about it, you'd turn it off.
Right, but I think you've got to think of this in a medical field sort of sense, right?
Right.
You've got all of this stuff hooked up. It's all medical equipment. A man is dying. You are not going to stop to fiddle with your machine.
Oh, but the person who operates the machine might not be the person who intervenes and tries to save the person's life.
Yeah, true. I mean, although I don't exactly know how it would work in a hospital. I mean, I suppose, is it not like if you are a doctor and you are standing next to someone and they start to like die. You start to die.
Yeah.
Are you going to hang around and wait for the right doctor to come, or are you going to...
No, no, I just mean that it might be a technician or something.
Oh, true. Yeah, no, it could be, I suppose, yeah.
I don't know how, but, how
yeah,
it works.
I suppose there must be protocols for when it is and isn't turned off then, you know? Mm. I just, yeah.
He had a do not resuscitate, didn't he?
He did have a, yeah.
Yeah. So they're probably like, yeah, just leave him.
Right.
I mean, yeah. Let him do his thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so interesting, that.
It's incredibly... I mean, they turned off... They turned it off after cardiac arrest, right? So I suppose... I don't even really know. You know, I suppose it's just not terribly invasive, right? You know, it's the little sticky things on your head, on the inside of your head, for anyone that doesn't know it.
It's just interesting. I'm just surprised there isn't like someone who goes, just turn that off, because it's almost like it almost feels insensitive to capture data. I'm not saying it is. I'm just saying I feel like someone might make that moral judgment, because you're ultimately gaining out of somebody's death, but it's very interesting data to have, of course.
Yeah, I suppose ethically I do understand how someone could make that argument. I think it's silly, though. I mean,
sure. Yeah.
I think, okay, so how do I put this? I think ethically speaking, it would be wrong to be filming someone on an iPhone or something, right, as they die. That just seems that because of the spectacle, right? I think in terms of the disrespect, it's disrespectful. In terms of making a spectacle out of someone's death. In terms of recording data from an EEG, I feel like that is not an issue of spectacle. That's not an issue of, oh, let's get this on YouTube. That's a case of, like, you know what I mean? Yeah. It's a case of, I mean, although we are getting it on YouTube now. So, I think it's more a case of this can help a lot of people.
Yeah.
Can it? How? I mean, it doesn't help. There's no... Well, it might eventually be a medical application for this, but it's like, this is more just interesting. Oh, this is what the brain does during death.
Well, you can make the argument they can help people in terms of comfort, you know?
Yeah.
And knowing...
Not if you've got loads of bad memories.
I mean, knowing what happens when you die could lend a comfort to people, you know what I mean? Like, having an answer, although I suppose having an answer could absolutely...
Yeah, because you can prepare somebody into like, well, this is our best guess is what you're going to experience. Mm-hmm. As you die, these sections of your brain turn off. You might experience an out-of-body experience because the area that deals with your sense of self and your sense of body will shut down first, and then your memories, like those are gamma rays, so you might see flashes of memories, and it sort of helps you pass into death without it being a scary experience. That's really interesting, actually.
Yeah, right? You know, because I think one of the deepest fears that we have as a species is, in a lot of fears are encompassed in this when you really think about it. It's the fear of the unknown, right? Mm. So people are scared of the dark. Kids are scared of the dark. Why are they scared of the dark? You don't know what's in the dark.
You don't know what's in there.
Exactly. You don't know what's in the dark.
Could be a monster.
Exactly. People can be scared of surprises and whatnot. Like, fear of the unknown is, I think, perhaps one of the most common fears, right?
Yeah.
You could even explain it in the uncanny valley. Like, that comes from a fear of the unknown, because it's just, there's something off and you can't read it. You can't read something that is too close to human without being fully human.
Yeah.
And so many things come from that. Even you could say bigotry, and all of that sort of stuff comes again from fear of the unknown, which is to an extent why meeting people from different groups can often resolve cases of bigotry, right? You know,
what's really funny about that and interesting though is that if you're so the fear of the unknown, right, comes, it's almost like an unknown variable. If you're trying to predict, if you're trying to like see what's going to happen, an unknown variable is very scary because there are infinite ways you could fill in that blank. And so your evolutionary response to an unknown variable is basically fear, right? Be on hyper alert, gather information as quickly as possible. Don't miss any information, because then you can gather, you might be able to predict the next second slightly quicker if you get it, right? So what's really interesting about that is that if you're scared of, like, for example, death, the idea of the unknown, well, that's the brain being scared of the unknown, because the brain can't calculate it because it's an unknown variable. The brain's going to die. Mm-hmm. If you like project, or you believe in some sort of immaterial soul, like an immortal soul, you don't have anything to fear, because no matter what your experience is after death, nothing can hurt you. You might have some bad experiences, but you are an immortal soul. You have just had an all right experience in your life, so another all right experience will come along. So the idea of the brain being scared of death in terms of it being the unknown is interesting, because the brain will die at death, so there's nothing you can do about that. And you, if you continue having some sort of experience after death, well, you're immortal then, in that case, then you have nothing to fear.
But then it's like playing a video game, right? You know, so if you playing a video game, you are the immortal soul. The character in the video game is essentially what you are, right, to your immortal soul.
Yeah.
So when you're playing a video game, you can get into that and get very, very much, like, you can feel scared because your character is in a dangerous situation in a video game.
Oh, that's because you've identified with the character, yeah.
Yeah, which...
In which case, you've made a mistake. As in, your brain has started simulating the future based on the outcomes for the character, which is very engaging and very interesting, but you've made a mistake.
Yeah, so thank you, Luke, for giving us a crash course on how to play video games incorrectly.
Yeah, sure. It's very fun, but you do it for the fun. But you're still wrong.
Be reckless with your gaming.
No, but in the same sense that if you feel scared of that, even scared for your immortal soul, your essence of you, right? It's similar to playing that video game and being like, oh man, I don't want to die. Even though it doesn't matter, right? Yeah. Like fundamentally speaking, with any video game, it is just code. You have absolute power over that if you want. There is someone out there that can make that game do anything.
Yeah.
Because it bends entirely to our whim, right? In terms of the game, while we may individually not be omnipotent because we, like, you know, you don't have the knowledge necessarily to break, you know, the new Grand Theft Auto or whatever, right? Yeah. You don't have the knowledge to do that personally. You are capable of attaining that knowledge, or at the very least capable of getting someone who has that knowledge to do this thing.
Yeah.
You are gods to video games in the same way that an immortal soul would be a god to whatever we experience, right? It is the exact same thing as, like, in being scared in a video game. It's the exact same thing as being scared of your soul leaving your body when you die.
Yeah.
Just the way that we can experience it.
Yeah.
It's just fun, isn't it?
It's just fun, isn't it?
Just fun.
Oh my God. Imagine. Sorry, I just... Imagine, right? Realizing that life, all of this, is essentially just a fun thing that the immortal souls do to unwind, you know?
I mean, that's like a leading... metaphysical new age idea. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well,
there was a Rick and Morty bit about that, wasn't there?
Was there?
Roy?
Oh, yeah, I love
a video
that.
Game called Roy.
Yeah, where you inhabit, an entire life.
And you really believe you're Roy, and then you live out, like, decades as this person, your perspective.
That's not far away from what we've got already. If I'm playing Pokemon, I am, even if the graphics are terrible, I am invested. If I try and remember my childhood playing Pokemon, I remember... doing stuff.
Yeah.
No, I don't remember sitting looking at... I remember, like, being in that world and doing all that stuff.
Yeah, true.
What? You remember it as if, whoa, that's so interesting.
Not, like, literally, like, I'm like, oh, I throw the ball, I'm like this. Like,
yeah,
I don't...
you're right. If I think about playing Ratchet and Clank on PlayStation, I absolutely am... Like, my brain cancels out the screen and the room around it.
Yeah.
I just experience, like, the view.
That's the screen,
so,
yeah.
That's
yeah.
so weird.
Yeah, exactly, right? And, like, if you try and... If I'm trying to remember, okay, what... in button inputs did I do, it's not, I don't remember that.
Yeah,
in the same way that
exactly.
I don't remember, like, I remember, like, my arms doing things. I don't remember thinking for the process to make my arms move, right? Because when you play a game enough, like, the button inputs just become an extension of your body. It's
I
insane.
I experienced this recently playing the new Pokemon game on
so
Switch
true,
with Rebecca, who hasn't, like, grown up playing an awful lot of video games, and her looking down at the controller before making decisions, and I was like, oh my gosh, like, I don't even remember the controllers there. And I'm like, it's just we have this understanding of the language of video games that she hasn't picked up. It's so interesting.
Interestingly, the new Pokemon game does something. So Pokemon Legends Arceus, Pokemon Legends Arceus, if you're gonna, people are gonna be the Pokemon Arceus fans in the comments and getting very annoyed about this. Pokemon Legends Arceus, they've actually switched up the sort of button inputs based on other similar games. So if you're playing The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild, the button inputs are different for different movements.
Yeah.
And that really threw me for a bit, because my brain would automatically be like, oh, jump. And I hit the jump button. And in Pokemon, that's not the jump button.
Yeah.
You know? It's really weird when you're very much used to, like...
Oh my God, sorry.
I think that's it. Okay.
Yeah.
And so it's really weird when you're very used to certain maps for controllers, and then it's just changed to something else. Like, it, it genuinely stunts your play.
Yeah,
you know,
it's like they have to add another layer of translation between you and the game.
Exactly.
Yeah. But you have to develop that layer of translation yourself. Ugh, very annoying.
But once it's
there, all the game developers could just agree one way of playing games.
But you say that, and yet they kind of did. Almost because they had to, right? Like, I mean, obviously back before, way back when it was one button and a joystick, then it was very simple, right?
You know, yeah, but not in Pokemon Legends Arceus. Up is pause.
Yeah.
Start is ride a horse. It's stupid. It's a terrible button layout.
I don't know why they did. They genuinely could have just taken Zelda's.
The amount of times I want to pause the game and I end up riding a flipping horse.
right?
Oh my god.
Yeah. It is a weird deer. Just going to say, before anyone in the comments is saying it's not a horse, it's a we know.
I don't know. I don't know. To me, it's a horse. I have no idea. I've never played any other Pokemon games.
It's a Pokemon reindeer.
Okay.
That Pokemon actually was not in any of the other games, but that's besides the point. Let's get back to this study. So to bring us back in, I actually have a quote. So this is from the paper. Unlike previous reports, our study is the first to use full EEG placement, which allows a more complete neurophysiological analysis in a larger dimension. Further, the data was explained was obtained from an acutely deteriorating patient. Previous human reports were limited to frontal cortex EEG signals that were analyzed by neuromonitoring devices, which may have captured artifacts, and the focus was set on critically ill patients in chronic settings. In line with our findings, electrical surges were also reported in these studies after cessation of blood circulation. So what that means is, after your heart stops, your brain is still going for a little bit, evidently. When I say your brain is still going, you can still see sort of spikes of electrical signals even after the heart has stopped. Which kind of makes sense, you know, like you can survive briefly with your heart stopped, you know, briefly. So it would make sense that the brain would have a little bit of activity after that. So what they're saying here is essentially that this study is sort of one of a kind and the farthest that they've gotten thus far, because it's a full EEG. The patient was dying in terms of like rapidly deteriorating to death, not sort of chronically ill person. He just sort of very suddenly died.
Yeah.
And so this is a brand new kind of data that they've got to work with. Mm. I kind of want to bring it to a close on the limitations now, though. So what do you think some of these limitations might be? I have six limitations from the paper itself.
Firstly, that it's muddled in with other data. So he's having a heart attack. He's having a seizure, so that might, like, the effects might not purely be caused by the transition from life to death.
Mm-hmm. Okay, fair. Yeah,
it's only one sample.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
It's only doing pattern, like brain waves.
Mm-hmm.
Which type of brain wave, as opposed to areas of the brain activation?
Yeah. Mm. So it's pretty solid. Yeah. So I'll just go through the six that I've got, because you kind of touched on different ones. So the first one is that the man had epilepsy, which can alter your gamma activity.
Ah.
And so he could be an anomaly in and of himself.
Yes.
Wow.
So that kind of falls into your one, you know, being one person.
Yeah.
And to be fair, there is no person. You know, we were talking about this the other week. Like, there is no human genome. There
Normal
is
person
no person.
Dying. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I mean, you can say that there are people that sway away from sort of baseline average way less, but finding the true neutral normal person, no. Otherwise, if we found that person, we would just do all of our studies on them.
You wouldn't need to do
like, wow, look at
this,
like,
is what science needs to do. They need to find the person,
find the most normal person,
prototypical human,
the find humanist human,
and just breed the clone humanist them.
Human. Yeah, the humanist human,
the humanist human, clone them and run,
and then kill them lots and lots of times.
Yeah.
You know, interestingly, that is how a DC villain, Doomsday, was essentially made.
Oh, no way.
They took a space baby, and they threw it onto a very harsh planet, and it died. And then whenever it died, they would, I think, clone it, and so it would evolve to not die the same way. And they just did that again and again and again, and then you've got something that can kill Superman.
That is just a video game.
I don't think that's how evolution works, but okay.
Okay. Have you killed Superman?
No.
There we go.
You got some evolving to do, buddy.
That is actually how, genuinely, how some creationists seem to think evolution works. I did a video the other day responding to a creationist, and he fully said, God, you can't evolve if you're dead, which, like, death is pretty much a key part of evolution, you know?
Yeah.
And also, you don't individually evolve.
Not a single, you know, one person does not evolve. One person can be a step in evolution. One person does not evolve.
Unlike in Pokemon's Arceus, where the Pokemons evolve.
Yeah, which is more of a metamorphosis than anything, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. But
yeah,
oh, that's kind of not the point. Back to the limitations. He had epilepsy, which can alter gamma activity, so he could be anomalous in that sense. There's also no way to know what he was seeing and experiencing. We only know what the brain signals were. That's kind of what you were saying there, Luke. The injury can also alter rhythmic brain activity. So he had a TBI, traumatic brain injury. Obviously, he fell, had those subdural hematomas, and that could have affected his brain, his sort of brain activity. Psychosis and drug use can also cause a surge in gamma waves. He was on anticonvulsants. That could affect, you know, the, and so, yeah, so that could affect neuronal activity. And there's also then the sixth, which I've mentioned earlier. Did you guys... I don't think you mentioned it. I've mentioned it, I think, twice earlier. It's one of the first things I said. Yeah.
Ooh. I don't know.
So they didn't have a baseline.
Oh, yeah.
Reading
No
baseline reading for him. So you don't have something else to compare it to, which is kind of problematic. But in talking about all of these, a quote from the a quote from the paper again, I just think is the best way to get this across, is that despite these caveats, the overall similarity in oscillatory changes between the highly controlled experimental rodent study and the present work suggests that the brain may pass through a series of stereotyped activity patterns during death. Essentially what it's saying is that this overall was fairly similar to what we've seen in rodents. So from that, despite all of those limitations of it, that similarity would suggest, or could suggest rather, that that it's still not terribly atypical, or that those limitations haven't necessarily affected the results too heavily.
Tell you where we will get an awful lot of data for this kind of thing. If we get to a world where the majority of people are wearing a brain interface chip, which is basically electrodes implanted into different areas of the brain, we'll get a load of data because people will die with them in, and and it will be recording that.
Yeah, and you don't think that's how they're going to make money as well? Fully.
What? People dying?
Oh, not people dying necessarily, but there are so many ways to make... There are so many awful ways to make money with these brain implants. Like, I mean, for one thing, you could put certain things behind paywalls, which is horrifying. But for another thing, you know how they're selling data from people that... You know, it's basically the way that, like, what they called 23andMe and all that stuff.
Yeah.
One of the ways that they make money, presumably, would be to sell data. Right.
I'm pretty sure 23andMe claim to not sell the data, or if they do sell, it will be aggregated data.
They give it away for free.
No, they just don't. They don't. But yeah, I think they do. Oh, yeah. Okay.
23andMe will not sell, lease, or rent your individual level information to a third party data, for research purposes without your explicit consent. Without your explicit consent. We will not share your data with any public databases. But what I'm saying here is not that 23andMe are selling your individual personalized data. No. What I'm saying is that ultimately, there is going to be a massive market for this kind of data.
Yeah.
And these companies, like, you might think, oh, the way that they make money is by by putting a lot of high margins on their... No, you stupid. No, they're going to sell data. Data is where money is. Yeah. Data is money.
Especially when you exist in a world where everybody, especially in the US, everybody has health insurance. The health insurance companies want ways of predicting death rates. If you can find aggregate data about people who have this trait or this gene will quite often die of this thing, cool. Sell it to the people, and then you just charge people money for that kind of stuff. And that's what it's really important to have. There are certain things that you can't use as a predictor of death age. So, for example, I think you're not allowed to use gender or sex as a predictor for death age. And so it means that men/women/male/female, whoever, don't have a different... Because I think women would have they would have lower chance of death, but that might, for example, make their insurance for example, like annuities, which is a thing where you transfer all the money you've saved up for your retirement and turn it into a pension. You would have a higher, because you're going to live longer, so your annuity would be more expensive. So that's not allowed, as far as I'm aware. It's not allowed to charge women more money for their annuities.
I mean, people talk about privatizing the NHS, and there are so many different factors to it. But when you look at the healthcare system in the US, it is shocking. I mean, you do not want to give more data to insurance companies, because they just use it to gouge people.
Yeah.
They absolutely will. Like, in insurance companies, health insurance companies in the US, disgusting. That whole industry is just messed up. the markup that they've got in hospitals, the fact that I think if you don't have insurance, it costs more for things, and they charge the insurance companies less because there are deals between insurance companies and hospitals and all of this sort of stuff. It is so messed up. Giving them excess data to work with is such a scary prospect. Yeah. Obviously, having that data for scientific pursuits seems incredible. But there are so many of these little things that aren't necessarily intuitive, especially for people that don't understand the technology whatsoever. I mean, we are probably slightly above the baseline level for most people.
Yeah.
But still, not even nearly close enough to remotely think of all of the sort of potential ramifications of this. And it's one of those things where I feel like this is why we need people in government that actually understand these things. Because ultimately, what's going to end up happening is these technologies are gonna happen.
Yeah.
And then laws are going to have to catch up. But by the time the laws are caught up, there's already damage has already been done. And there's a new technology on the horizon that's going to, blindside them.
If you've ever seen those interviews with, Zuckerberg in front of the Supreme Court or to Congress, where nobody knows a single thing about how any of this stuff works. It's literally just, these senators, airing their grievances about things and just, getting just a basic stuff wrong.
Yeah.
It's just so painful. These are people who are upholding our democracy.
But they can get it. That means they can get away with it, though. That means that you can, if you're a tech company, it's probably far easier for a tech company to not break the law, but do something morally repugnant and just get away with it because no one's actually figured out it's morally
repugnant.
We just don't understand. What have you done? Well, they do some technobabble and then everyone's like, so can you? Is that a good thing or a bad thing? What's actually?
But there are also, I think there are also examples where actually the technology is misunderstood the opposite way, where Congress or whoever is sort of projecting a fear into the outcome of something, and actually it's sort of not as bad as it sounds.
True, true. I mean, I think definitely. I would even say that happens with a lot of the stuff with stem cell research and cloning and all of those things. There are very heavy sort of measures on those in a lot of places. I think except in China, you're pretty solid with that kind of research. I think we've spoken about that before. But there are heavy limitations on that kind of research, which holds us back in a number of ways. But because we have moral objections to it,
pro-life stuff.
Pro-life, we don't really understand the science behind it and all of this sort of stuff. I mean, you can even say that pushback against let's call them mRNA pre-illness.
Oh, you're talking about those things that you put in your body to make you not be ill, so that you don't get ill?
Yes, things you put in your body to train your body for a potential oncoming illness.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
What letter do they begin with?
Not going to do it.
Okay. I'm sure you can do the letter.
A V. They start with a V.
Yeah.
But interestingly, there's a lot of pushback against those, in the mRNA aspect, because apparently people think they might alter your DNA, which, if you've taken the most basic class on mRNA, is literally not the function for messenger RNA, which is literally what the M stands for. People's lack of knowledge on these things just results in just so much harm, and not just harm, but also holding us back when we don't need to be held back. It's just, oh boy. Maybe there should be more focus on understanding the things you're making laws about,
Imagine not having gone to your mRNA class. You silly billies.
It is literally in high school biology.
Is it?
Yeah, high school biology, you learn about mRNA.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. No. Do you learn it's called mRNA?
Yeah.
Wow. So I would have learned it.
Pretty sure, yeah.
I don't have any recollection of it.
I did not do biology.
No, I'm not like basic high school level. I think higher, advanced higher, or okay. A-levels maybe.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure.
It's very hard to gauge higher, what it is. Higher biology are probably not the people who are worried about mRNA, Corey. If we're going to teach it, we need to teach it quite early.
Maybe we should.
No, I mean, it's complex stuff. It's interesting, but it's like you learn about DNA and then you learn about RNA. And then I guess you kind of learn about the different types of RNA. And when you were looking into what happens in cells, that's when you start learning about mRNA, because that's how sort of, when you're starting learning about sort of protein synthesis and cell replication and stuff, that's where that kind of comes in. And oh boy, is it frustrating to actually see people saying this is going to change, they're trying to change your genes with something that doesn't do that. Like, it just doesn't do that. I cannot imagine what it's like to be a scientist and see people just wildly misunderstand your work, you know? Yeah. But back to this sort of paper, those limitations that we mentioned, you know, the epilepsy, the lack of a baseline, all of those things, because the results were similar to what they'd seen in rodents, they were somewhat confident that this isn't just junk data that should be discarded. They were saying, essentially what they're saying is that it's, and here's a quote, "It may be ultimately difficult to assess this in a physiological environment since gathering such data from healthy subjects is impossible by definition. We do not anticipate death in healthy subjects and therefore could not obtain uninterrupted recordings in the near-death phase in anything other than from circumstances involving pathological conditions in acute care, in acute care hospital settings." So essentially what they're saying is that, look, this data we think is it's pretty good. It seems to line up with previous data that we've got on it, right? So we shouldn't necessarily just discard it because of these limitations. And also, it's very difficult to get future data on this. Like, we literally cannot just build a study around this because we can't look at a healthy person that just suddenly dies, right? There's always going to be another factor that you could say is potentially the cause of this, because people are, if we know someone's going to die, they got something wrong with them, right?
I suppose that's sort of almost, that feels almost irrelevant, because you don't die just, unless you're in a, like an accident in some way, you don't die of nothing. You usually die of something.
But then near-death experiences are generally due to cardiac arrest and resuscitation, which could potentially happen basically through trauma, right? I mean, this man died from trauma, right?
Okay.
So if we're talking about a traumatic death, in that
case... Do you
mean
trauma...
Case, oh, sorry.
Psychological trauma?
No. I'm talking about physical trauma.
Okay.
No. Okay. I'm talking purely, like, sort of, as in like an injury.
Yeah.
You know, so that kind of trauma. Like, he had a TBI, so that's what he died from.
Yeah.
If you were to, like, so it's really difficult to do this, unless of course we get to the point that you're saying, where we just have things in our head
chips
all the time
in
that
our
are
heads.
Constantly measuring that. But with that kind of world, there is so much data that you can just get from so many different places. It'd be very, I think. You know, we've had a massive jump in the sort of technology and science and all of this sort of stuff. And I feel like there are a few things that if we just make those changes to society, and bear in mind, they would be massive changes where, you know, most people in, I'm talking like even 10% of people in developed countries, let's say, hate that term. Mm. 10% of people in developed countries
industrialized,
sure.
Most industrial countries, yeah.
Yeah, the white ones on the West, you know.
Oh dear. Yeah.
Look, that's what people mean when they say that, right? You know, Jesus. In those countries, you know, even 10% of people with these sort of brain implants, massive, massive shift to our society, obviously. But the data that you could get from that would, I genuinely think, push us forward massively. Massively. And it'd be really interesting to see that happen, but obviously there are lots of things that could...
Yeah, you got to figure out your law stuff there about, like, how you make that data available and whether it's, like, publicly available, like the aggregated data is just publicly available so anybody can study it. Yeah, it gets real messy.
Absolutely
quite
does.
Quickly.
Absolutely does. But until then, we have got this study, which is pretty cool, I think. Pretty good. Mm-hmm. I mean, not obviously good that a man died, but pretty awesome that we managed to get, pretty much for the first time, some kind of data on what happens when you die. And apparently this data could support the idea, the experience, the theory almost, that your life flashes before your eyes when you die.
Really cool.
Wow.
Oh, very good. So I hope that your lives are going to flash before your eyes right now while we do the quick fire quiz.
Yeah. The last hour of my life. Come on.
Dun, 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 dun. Near death edition.
So the rules of the quickfire quiz are exactly the same as always. I'll ask one question between the two of you. The first person to buzz in with the correct answer after I finish to answer the question wins. What do they win, champ?
Nothing.
No, this time you win.
Oh, a near-death experience.
Yeah.
Wow. What?
Yeah.
How are you going to trigger it?
You don't want to ask that.
Yeah. I'll let you know.
Champ's strangulation plan.
Luke, what is your buzzer?
Oh,
peace.
My final breath.
Champ, what is your buzzer?
Ooh. It's just the ghost after you die.
Ah, yes. Yeah. Very good.
It's me watching myself, my own body.
So, the question is, what year did the case study actually happen? champ?
2016.
Hooray! Hey, correct. Yeah. Well done. Fantastic. Thank you. You win a near-death experience.
Oh, no, I should...
I shouldn't have led this one.
Well, that is it for this week. Is there anything else you want to say before we go?
I hope you have a lovely near-death experience.
I would just like to say that I hope that at some point in the future we have standardized sticking an EEG on your head when you're nearly about to die. Because I'd be fine with that. If I'm about to die, my family are around me.
Yeah.
Stick an EEG on my head.
Just like a little helmet or something.
Yeah, yeah, except what you're forgetting is that whenever you go to the hospital, you're going to brick it when they start putting an EEG on your head.
Oh, not the poop.
Because that means the doctors think you're going to die.
No, I mean you have a discussion with the person and you go, look, we think you're going to die. In the same way that you have the discussion about like organ donation, although if you're very old you probably don't. And you go, we think you're going to die, or you know you're going to die. In that situation where you've been told you're going to die and it's going to happen in these times, would you like to donate your brainwaves to science?
Yeah, like an organ donor.
And I'd say yes.
Yeah,
sure.
Opt-in.
Again, though, Luke, I feel like your brainwaves are going to be far away from the baseline. I don't think...
His won't stop. He'll be dead for like half a century and they'll still be going.
I'm still here.
So before we go, we would like to thank all of our patrons, with a very special thank you to executive producers Rosa Rodriguez and Danito. And also, thank you for watching. You can find the full references for this episode in the description. Subscribe for new episodes every Sunday, and why not leave us a nice wee comment. You can support the pod at patreon.com/SciGuys, or you can find and contact us at SciGuysPod on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and here on YouTube, and at SciGuys on TikTok too. Or you can send us an email at SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
That's SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
You can follow me at NotCore everywhere.
You can follow me at Champkin everywhere.
You can follow me at Luke Cupfold everywhere.
Goodbye.
Rest easy.
Goodbye.
No!
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.